when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we discuss the attack and strike in occupied Ukraine that has reportedly killed over 100 Russian soldiers. We analyse French President Emmanuel Macron's take on world affairs, and we get the latest from Kharkiv with the Trident Defence Initiative.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's gonna break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Thursday, the 2nd of May. 2 years and 69 days since the full-scale invasion began. And today I'm joined by our Associate Editor Dominic Nichols, Assistant Comment Editor Francis Sternley, Brussels Correspondent Joe Barnes, and our guest is Daniel Ridley, Head of the Trident Defence Initiative. I started by asking Dom for the latest news from Ukraine.
Well, hi David, hi everybody. So let's start inside Ukraine in the east, in the occupied region. More than 100 Russian soldiers said to have been killed in an attackams strike, one of the highest single losses of Russian lives in many, many months. Drone footage shared on social media purportedly shows the moment the US supplied ballistic missiles smash into a training ground in the Russian held area around Mozhenivka in Luhansk in the east. As many as four cluster munition versions of the weapon were used. These scatter shell fragments, think chunky ball bearings, basically, over a very large area. One appeared to have been a dud. You're going to get these the failure rate. I'm not sure what it is for attackers. I think it's something like 5%, or that might be. I think that's the submunition rather than the missile itself. But, you know, it's going to happen. Now, at least one of the missiles appeared to hit a group of around 100 Russian soldiers, according to open source analysis of the video. The ISW, Institute for the Study of War, US-based think tank, highlighted the strike in a recent battlefield report, saying Kyiv's forces had hit a Russian training ground about 50 miles behind the front line in Luhansk region. Now, Ukraine, you'll remember, was given the short-range version of ATACMS, the Army Tactical Missile System, last autumn. This older version disperses submunitions, deadly sort of cluster bomblets as it hits the target, good for killing personnel in the open and destroying soft-skinned vehicles. It's thought to be the only weapon in Ukraine's arsenal that can deliver a cluster strike that ranges over 50 miles. Then further south, in the third missile attack on Odessa in as many days, Moscow says its forces have attacked the command headquarters of Ukraine's Southern Army grouping in Odessa, as I say. Moscow's defense ministry said operational and tactical aviation missile forces and artillery were used. We've no way of knowing what they used or necessarily what was hit there, if they did hit the Southern Army grouping headquarters. But Oleg Kiper, who's the governor of Odessa region, he said 14 people were injured in the strike after civilian infrastructure, including a postal warehouse, was damaged. Pictures and video online, posted online, show flames, huge clouds of smoke engulfing buildings. 18 employees of Novopochta, that's a private postal and courier service, were at the site but had made their way safely to a bomb shelter before the missile hit what they said was a loading section of the depot. I'll say it again. You used to be a superpower, lad. Now you're targeting postal depots. Anyway, elsewhere, Russian attacks in Kharkiv, Dnipropetrovsk, Kherson, Mykolaiv, Sumy, Zaporizhia and Donetsk Oblast killed and injured dozens of civilians yesterday. This comes from regional authorities reporting. However, in some areas, what are they using to do it? Well, last night, the US State Department said that Russia is using chloropicrin. Sorry, I've been bloody practicing this all morning. Chloropicrin, a chemical first deployed in the First World War, widely used in, well, contained within crowd control elements. Use of this on the battlefield is banned under the Chemical Weapons Convention, which Russia has signed and ratified and ignored. Sorry, I added the last bit, but I think we all know what's happening here. Chloropicrin is a toxic lung-damaging agent used in CS gas. Russia's use of this weapon was first revealed by us, actually, Telegraph investigation a couple of months ago, which found that Russia was dropping gas grenades that had forced Ukrainian soldiers to change tactics. Now, the US State Department said that Russian use of riot control agents, as in tear gas, as a method of warfare in Ukraine, was also a violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention. But back in April, last month, we were talking about how chemical grenades filled with this active agent, had been dropped in trenches. The soldiers in those trenches are then, I guess, a natural human response, trying to get out if they haven't got proper protection, and then attacked with other means by Russia. This stuff, I mean, tear gas, CS gas, and these agents are heavier than air, so they will sink into trenches and underground bunkers. But we spoke to some frontline troops back in April about these attacks, and Ihor, we quoted this at the time, but Ihor, the commander of a Ukrainian reconnaissance team who's deployed near Chasiv Yar, he said that even when not lethal, as in the blast from these things, not lethal or immediately incapacitating, the gas normally causes panic. He said people's first instinct was to get out, and they're then attacked with more conventional weapons. And just lastly for me, David, Russia is said to be using kamikaze drones over the reactors of the occupied Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, risking what's been described as catastrophic consequences. This comes from Ukraine's military intelligence agency, the HUR, speaking this morning. They published intercepted camera footage of a Russian drone over the plant. You'll remember this is the largest nuclear power station in Europe, been under Russian occupation since March 22, and Ukraine has repeatedly accused Moscow of using the plant as a launching site for drone attacks, which obviously presents a huge security hazard there. Military intelligence spokesperson Andrei Cherniak, speaking to the Babel News outlet, said that because Russia uses the nuclear power station as a drone launching point, Ukraine can't fire back to within 1.5 kilometres around the plant. The statement from the HUR said, the occupiers have established drone launch sites right next to the sixth reactor of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. The statement also said that since last summer, Russia's been using the grounds of the plant to train drone pilots. The HUR said that altogether this new information was yet, well, they say, more evidence of the criminal and irresponsible behaviour of the Russian aggressor state at the occupied nuclear facility, which could have catastrophic consequences. One we'll definitely be keeping an eye on and probably chatting to Hamish about, David. And that's us up to date, and I'll take a pause.
Well, thank you very much, Dom. Let's move then to international diplomacy and politics. Francis Sternley, what have you been looking at?
Well, thanks, David. It only seems right to start once again with Georgia, where civil unrest continues to escalate following the Georgian parliament's moving a step closer yesterday to passing that law critics fear will stifle media freedom and indeed endanger the country's European Union membership bid. Police used water cannons, tear gas and pepper spray against the tens of thousands of protesters. I emphasise that. This is not small scale. This is huge. Who throng the surrounding streets. The footage is quite extraordinary, with entire blocks crammed with protesters. This is truly a mass demonstration which will be remembered for a very long time. Now, I won't repeat all of the context to this, but just to say that 83 of Georgia's 150 lawmakers approved the bill in its second reading, while 23 voted against. A third and final vote, crucially in the parliament, is needed before it can be signed into law. That is expected in mid-May. So that means this row is going to drag on for at least a couple more weeks. And that, of course, leaves opportunities for this to only escalate. Now, for our purposes, it is Russia's support of this bill and the governing party's tilt towards Moscow that is the cause of so much concern. As regular on the podcast James Kilner put it in a tweet yesterday, Russian missiles destroyed Donbass, police in Tbilisi beat protesters, Aliyev humiliates Pashinyan and arrests journalists in Baku. The front line between democracy and authoritarianism runs through Ukraine, splits Georgia, and divides Armenia and Azerbaijan. So, as he emphasizes, this shouldn't be seen in isolation. This is connected with a lot of what is going on at the moment. Many on the ground in Georgia are making comparisons, rightly or wrongly, with Ukraine's Maidan protests in 2013. So, of course, a hugely significant event in that country, just to give you a sense of scale here. Now, for more on the evolving picture, I recommend listening to the previous episodes this week, especially yesterday's, where we spoke to the Kyiv Independent's man on the ground. But turning westwards now, Emmanuel Macron has given a major new interview with The Economist 5 years after he told them famously about the brain death of NATO. It is a fascinating long read, far too rich to do justice to here. So I'll point listeners to it instead, whilst drawing attention to some of the most interesting segments relevant to geopolitics. He doubled down on his speech at the Sorbonne, in which he first said, "Our Europe can die." Indeed, he speaks with even greater sense of urgency. "Things can fall apart very fast," he says, "and the end can be brutal." He identifies Russia as the main threat, saying it is systematically using, quote, "aggression in all known domains of conflict," and that a victory in Ukraine for Moscow means that Moldova, Romania, Poland, Lithuania, and any neighbour are at risk. The key headline, though, and I imagine listeners are waiting to see what he would say on this, is that Macron does stand by his refusal to rule out sending ground forces to help Ukraine. Quote, "If the Russians were to break through the front lines, if there were a Ukrainian request, we would legitimately have to ask ourselves this question." Now, as listeners will know, I don't think he's mad to say that. Given the nature of the threat posed by Russia, I think it is not politically possible to allow Ukraine to fall now. So in the very worst case scenarios, Europe would indeed be compelled to draw red lines in the country. Now, to quote Macron in full, "I'm not ruling anything out," he says, "because we are facing someone who is not ruling anything out. We have undoubtedly been too hesitant by defining the limits of our action to someone who no longer has any and who is the aggressor. Our capacity is to be credible, to continue to help, to give Ukraine the means to resist. But our credibility also depends on a capacity to deter by not giving full visibility as to what we will or will not do. Otherwise, we weaken ourselves, which is the framework within which we have been operating until now. In fact, many countries said that in the weeks that followed, they understood our approach, that they agreed with our position, and that this position was a good thing. I have a clear strategic objective. Russia cannot win in Ukraine. If Russia wins in Ukraine, there will be no security in Europe. Who can pretend that Russia will stop there? So yes, we mustn't rule anything out because our objective is that Russia must never be able to win in Ukraine." And then he goes on just to drill this point further. "If Russia decides to go further, we will be in any case all have to ask ourselves urgent questions. That's why I wanted this strategic wake-up call for our counterparts, but also for all nations. France is a country that has carried out military interventions, including in recent times. We deployed several thousand troops in the Sahel to fight terrorism, which would have posed a threat to us. We did so at the request of sovereign states. If the Russians were to break through the front lines, if there were a Ukrainian request, we would legitimately have to ask ourselves this question. So I think to rule out a priori is not to learn the lessons of the past 2 years. At the NATO summit in the summer of 2022, we all ruled out the delivery of tanks, deep strike missiles, aircraft. We are now all in the process of doing this. But above all, it would be wrong in terms of credibility and deterrence vis-a-vis the Russians to rule it out. I note, by the way, that the aggressiveness of the Russian response to what I first showed was having the desired effect, which was to say, don't think we will stop here if you don't stop. Wow, quite a comprehensive analysis, which I think would echo what many have been saying for the past 2 years. Now, another interesting snippet from the interview related to Russia is where he says that Russia is a threat that we know and have always seen. I'm speaking for all Europeans, particularly for Germany and France, because we were responsible for saving the Minsk agreements and the Normandy process. We were right to take the diplomatic route, and this is the interesting bit. I have no regrets about what was done during all those years. These steps undoubtedly slowed things down and also enabled us to build joint European demands with regard to Putin. Now, I don't want to be unfair to Mr. Macron, but that does seem to suggest there was a long-term policy of containing Russia, a nod to the ideas of the 30s that you would appease short-term whilst preparing for the worst long-term, whether militarily or otherwise. But I think many would question that view of the period. It would be one for historians, not least with Nord Stream, which made Germany dependent on Russian energy, and also, of course, most obviously, the lack of armament. But anyway, that's a conversation for another time. Just onto the other subjects covered in the interview, he said there is no question of brushing NATO aside. Europe, in line, has to get ready to protect itself in order to hedge against future US disengagement and a way to lighten the American burden. Europe is not reduced to the EU. Quite an interesting remark, that, I think. He also discusses China at length and how he worries Europe will fall behind fatally if it doesn't make the right investments in clean tech and disruptive innovation now. What kills me in France, as in Europe, is the spirit of defeat. Politics isn't about reading polls. It's a fight. It's about ideas. It's about convictions. Now, listeners will know my own view, but as we always say, dramatic pause for those saying it aloud at home, deeds, not words, Monsieur Macron. But nonetheless, this is a really important long read, which I'll put in the show notes for listeners, because there's so much that I haven't covered here, which is also relevant to our stories today. Just very quickly, David, I know I've been going on a bit, but there's a lot happening. Quick stories. German left-wing extremists have launched an arson attack on the summer home of the chief of Rheinmetall, a major German arms manufacturer, in protest at his support for Ukraine. In an anonymous post on social media, the activists said they targeted his house because he was a profiteer of the so-called Zeitenwende, referring to Germany's new European security strategy towards Russia, of course. We placed an incendiary device on his garden house, the group said, not identifying themselves. Rheinmetall is one of the beneficiaries of this so-called turning point, and various old types of tanks that could now be sold to Ukraine with ammunition and at a hefty profit. Now, their remarks about tanks here specifically is because this company has been involved in the refurbishment of the Leopard tanks, which, of course, were formerly gathering dust in a Belgian warehouse, but then were sent to the front. The arsonists are believed to maybe have links with the German Red Army faction, revealing in itself. The German police said the arson attack caused limited damage on the property and the blaze was quickly brought under control by firefighters. Now, a small story in the grand scheme, but relevant as evidence of how far some far-left movements in Europe, like figures, of course, on the harder right as well, have found themselves in a pro-Putin position for an array of ideological reasons. In this specific case, questions will also be asked about where the money is coming from for outfits like this and whether it may or may not, as historically, have been funneled from Moscow. And just lastly, the Swiss government this morning has said that Russia is not invited to talks set to be held mid-June aimed at bringing peace between Moscow in Ukraine and Ukraine at this stage. Quote, Switzerland is convinced that Russia must be involved in this process. A peace process without Russia is not possible, but now is not the time. As listeners will know, Switzerland's shown openness to inviting Russia, but Moscow's repeatedly made it clear itself that it has no interest in participating in this first summit. As part of their argument, Russia has pointed towards Switzerland's adoption of the EU sanctions against Moscow and argued it therefore lacks credibility as a neutral broker. Once again, it is difficult to see how at this stage of the war, with both sides seemingly unflinching in their commitment to their own definitions of victory, or at least not feeling compelled to go to the negotiating table, what talks right now will realistically achieve. But nonetheless, they were at Zelensky's request, so evidently they have something in mind, the Ukrainians, if only to keep the urgency of the situation in the headlines. So those are the top lines, David. A lot happening, though I know Joe has even more stories of what's going on in Europe at present.
Well, thank you very much, Francis and Dom. Joe Barnes, it's great to get you back on. I know before you go off for some much needed and much deserved rest and recuperation. A couple of stories from you then. Can we start in Latvia?
Yeah, hi folks. So, but Latvia has urged its citizens to start converting their basements into air raid shelters, basically amid fears that the Baltic states could be Vladimir Putin's next target if he's allowed to succeed in Ukraine. So Vilnis Kersis, who is the mayor of Riga, the capital of Latvia, he said, "We call on everyone during the big cleanup, but also afterwards, to ensure that your cellars, your basements, can be used as shelters in case of emergencies." So for a bit of context, the big cleanup is a Latvian initiative where they basically get citizens to clean up parks, museums, government buildings, just make the place look nicer, which is a good sense of camaraderie, I guess. But it then went further. So in a private communique to city officials, the mayor said that government buildings would also have their underground spaces turned into shelters. So why is this important? Latvia is a member of NATO and the EU, but it also is a former sub-Soviet republic. It shares a 132-mile border with Russia and basically is one of those many people, many countries, warning of an increasing threat from Moscow. Sort of the Baltics are the first in line. If you read lots of, I guess you call them assessments of how Russia could attack, you look at Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania as being the first targets because of their geography. And then, so the head of Riga's Civil Defence Commission said in an interview with local broadcasters on the day of the big cleanup that 100 shelters would be prepared every month until the end of the year. So Gints Reisens said the basements of public buildings, schools, retirement homes, hospitals, town halls will be inspected by the authorities, who will prepare them to serve as hiding places in the event of an attack. Yes, that's basically, it's just part of the grand scheme of things of what's happening in that part of the world. So it's a nice way of illustrating it. It shows that people are taking practical steps to actually prepare for something, even if it is actually a distant prospect. It might never happen. People say 20 years, people say 6 years, that we could be at war with Russia as NATO rather than as aiding Ukraine. But I'll stop there and go to an interesting story which came out via The Insider, which is a Russian investigative journalism outfit, about a couple who run a hotel on the Greek coast, and they were unmasked as Russian spies behind a series of several deadly attacks on ammunition warehouses in the Czech Republic. So Nikolai and Alina Nikov, they bought the three-story hillside Villa Elena, which sort of grand, illustrious, it looks beautiful, and I believe it's actually available on booking.com and those kind of websites, Expedia, etc., until 2020. So it features a lovely outdoor swimming pool, a large garden, sits on the coast of the Aegean Peninsula. Of Chalkidiki. So they purchased that in 2009. But sort of before that, they have this quite interesting story. Hotel, after they bought it, served as a safe house as well as a hotel for members of the GRU. That's Vladimir Putin's sort of shadowy intelligence agency, known for carrying out attacks on foreign soil. Then back to the context of what they were really basically accused of. So in 2014, Russian military intelligence set off explosions at an armed depot in a village in the southeast of the Czech Republic, basically in a bid to thwart supplies to Ukraine, but also to Georgia. At the time, if you think the sort of the first war between Russia and governments that were moving westerly started happening. I think Donbass, Crimea, and then Abkhazia up in Georgia. So the hoteliers were said to have facilitated access to at least two of these warehouses at the facility for Alexander Mishkin and Anatoly Chepiga, who, for keen watchers of Russian intelligence agencies, would remember those names as people, the two men who were charged in absentia by the UK police with poisoning the Russian double agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in Salisbury. So the two hoteliers allegedly had direct contact with a guy called General Andrei Avrionov, who is the commander of GRU's unit 29155, who he basically was the guy who oversaw the clandestine operations in Salisbury, but also in the Czech Republic. But the insider described these two hoteliers, the Sapinivkovs, as deep cover spies, also known as illegals, because they were operating without diplomatic cover. You'd think back when countries expel diplomats, happens quite a lot to Russian diplomats, that's because they're actually intelligence officials on sort of Vienna Convention diplomatic passports. So, and then going back to the hotel, at least four members of Unit 2915 have known to have stayed at the hotel between 2012 and 2018. Data from a burner phone used by General Avrionov was also found to suggest that he had stayed in the vicinity of Villa Elena on several occasions. So we can't confirm it completely, but it's likely that he stayed there. So in 2023, the Czech authorities requested the extradition of the Sapinivkovs from Greece after an investigation into their alleged role in the bombings at these two warehouses. A final decision from the Greek authorities is still pending, but only for Elena, because her husband died in February of a heart attack, age 62. So basically a separate investigation by the Czech security services found Unit 29155 to be behind explosions at these government-run weapons and ammunition depots. The probe resulted in the expulsion of, and so 18 Russian diplomats, actually intelligence officers, who were operating in the country under the pretense of diplomatic cover. The explosive devices were said to have personally been planted by Mishkin and Chepiga, so those guys from Salisbury, the ones who said they loved church spires so much on telly, and that's why they visited and were spotted in the UK before Skripal was poisoned. So basically, then the insider then told this fantastic story of how Mrs. Koff was directly connected to Unit 2915. She was the supervisor of her husband and their son's pro-Kremlin activities. So as well as providing logistical support and safe haven for Russian operatives, the family was said to have gathered intelligence and helped recruit on behalf of Moscow. They both met in sort of Soviet Kyiv, and then eventually moved across sort of the Soviet Union, found themselves in the Czechoslovakia, and then basically stayed there after it dissolved and has become Chechnya rather than the Czech Republic. So Nikolai was a former Soviet army officer. He eventually caught the attention of Czech investigators because of his role at IMAX, which is an arms company set up to serve European military still using Soviet hardware at the time. Their son Pavel, who was once a member of the Czech Pirate Party, a left-wing movement, sort of anarchist, mainstream anarchism, I guess, also went on to work for that company. The Czech authorities started looking into the family because they lived a lavish lifestyle, despite Nikolai only making sort of $650 a month from his role. Elena also owned companies in the Marshall Islands and had two bank accounts in Switzerland. They found uncharacteristic of earning less than $1,000 a month. But then back to their sort of their main involvement in this new warehouse bombing. So it's alleged that General Avrionov had been tipped off about shipments of weapons intended for Ukraine, Georgia, and Syria. You'd remember that the Russians at the time were propping up Assad's government as there was a coup going on there. And the Western governments were backing the sort of the freedom fighters, the coup, launching the coup. I wouldn't really call it a coup, just a revolt. So GRU agents started moving into the Czech Republic in October 2014, where they've basically been granted entry to these warehouses on the pretense that it was organized through IMEX and the Sapinivkovs. And then suddenly on October 16th, 2014, a massive explosion engulfed the facility's warehouse 16, destroying aircraft engines and artillery shells owned by EMCO, which is another company dealing in Soviet-era kit. Two employees were killed at the depot. A month and a half later, in a shock, so on December the 3rd, artillery and mortar rounds, as well as assault rifles, started exploding in another warehouse at the same facility. The Sapinivkovs told police their links to Unit 29155 were personal, and they did not know its members were linked to state terrorism. They accused the authorities of political persecution because of their Russian background and said the 2014 explosions were a result of industrial accidents. So just a sort of a colourful look at intelligence operations on foreign soil and how the Russians actually carry them out. And I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Joe, for that deep dive there on that fascinating story of Russian spies, alleged Russian spies in Greece. Let's turn to our guest then, Daniel Ridley, head of the Trident Defence Initiative. Daniel, we've spoken to you quite a few times. Could you just very briefly reintroduce yourself to our listeners?
Hi, thank you. Yeah, it's great to be back on again. My name is Daniel Ridley, and I'm the founder of Trident Defence Initiative. We are a military training organisation based in Ukraine, working officially for the Ukrainian Armed Forces, providing training. I myself am a veteran of the British Army, and I also served 3 years in the Ukrainian Army prior to the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. So far, we've trained around 14,000 students, graduates of the courses.
Well, Daniel, let's start with your situation in Kharkiv. Can you? We've been talking about Kharkiv a lot over the past months. Of course, I spoke to a journalist yesterday who'd been there very recently and spoke about the terror, really, that the KAB glide bombs inspired. Can you tell us what it's been like living in and around Kharkiv, and what would you want our listeners to understand about what that's like at the moment?
So, yeah, I've been living and working in Kharkiv upwards of 2 years now. And prior to the counteroffensive up here in, I believe, September 2022, the city was under effectively a frontline area. It was under a lot of conventional fire from anything, artillery, rockets, even mortars. Cluster munitions were more commonly used here than anywhere else in Ukraine at the time. Post counteroffensive, once the Russians were pushed further out the region and up to the border, we then moved on to the next phase of Russian bombardment, which primarily focused on S-300 missiles that the Russians had sort of engineered to be able to be used as ground attack missiles. Wildly inaccurate, caused a lot of damage to the city, a lot of civilian casualties, and they were used to quite a good terror effect. And due to the proximity of Kharkiv city itself to the Russian Federation, we have no warning, no ability to counteract these threats. That continued ever since. The city's been under almost daily bombardment, if not weekly bombardment, ever since then. And then we saw a real upsurge of it in January of this year, when there was the new North Korean versions of these missiles. I believe it's a copy of the Russian Iskander missile, which was slated to be very inaccurate and a huge failure rate, and nothing from North Korea works, which is mostly true. Unfortunately, we saw that wasn't really the case with these missiles here. They turned out to be more accurate. They turned out to be more damaging. And they began to be used in January of this year. In the last, I'd say, month, increased drastically. I'm not sure on what the official Ukrainian position is on these CABs, but it seems very likely that they're a new form of the guided bomb, third or even fourth generation, if you will, which now has a jet-assisted function, so it's able to reach further distances. It's able to be more accurate. And we've seen these used daily in Kharkiv and Kharkiv region since then. The only, I wouldn't say benefit of it, but the only difference of it is there's a lot more of a warning time as opposed to a missile launch. The planes have to get in the air. They have to get onto what they call the launch lines, where they can safely launch these new glide bombs or jet-assisted glide bombs. And it gives people time to get into cover. But unfortunately, just yesterday in Zolochiv, which is a town just north of Kharkiv, two civilians were killed as Russia launched two of these into the center of the town, killing civilians. And that's a daily occurrence. Even today, we had these across the region. And even more recently, a lot of them have been hitting the city. So it's become more and more difficult for people in Kharkiv. But they do continue to live relatively normally. And a lot of people are in the city, and the city's quite vibrant as opposed to how it was a year ago.
Yes, I was going to ask, what's your sense of the morale of the city at the moment, considering the new KABs? Do you think it's changed much in the past 2 years? And I'm just curious, I mean, do you have a sense of anybody moving, or are most people staying put at this point?
So I was relatively confident that especially in January, with all this, I'd say, hype, or this new wave of missiles, North Korea, and the increased bombardments back in January, as well as a story which I think the Telegraph themselves broke and other outlets broke, of this expected Russian offensive on Kharkiv, which never materialized as of yet. We expected either an exodus of people, more, say, not forced evacuations, but mandatory evacuations of people living closer to the border with Russia and the contact line. That hasn't really been the case. Even with these new cabs that are being used and targeting, this city remains very busy. Just a couple of days ago, the local Telegram chats actually warned people. They had some sort of prior warning. Hey, get out of the Central Park. Something's coming. We don't know what. We can't say what. Get out the Central Park. Something's coming. And lo and behold, 5 or 10 minutes later, two cabs bombed pretty much next to the Central Park. Something like that. And summer here, I believe it's something like 24 degrees today. It's almost like Spain. And people are out. They're out in the park. There's, you know, the city's very busy, very vibrant. So, no, I don't think it's had a massive impact on people leaving the city. I believe, as per the mayor of Kharkiv, well over a million and a half people are currently living here.
Daniel, can we talk a little bit about your training? How has that changed since we last spoke? What kind of improvements have you made? What kind of lessons have you learned from what you're hearing from the soldiers when they come to you?
Obviously, it's something I think I mentioned last time we were together, but obviously the trainings are always adapting and always changing and limited in some things that I can say due to obviously operational security and everything like that. But the training obviously adapts and it changes from lessons learned from the Ukrainian side, but also lessons learned from the Russian side, and also lessons learned from the NATO projects that are going on. So obviously we're not at a level or able to compete, if competition could be used as a word for that, with the training that's being provided in the West. Obviously, we have a more direct approach. We're on the ground. We're not affiliated with any government or anything. But we're learning these lessons every day, and we're trying to adapt the training as much as possible to the Ukrainians. Still, one of our biggest focuses is medical training and improving that standard of medical training for the Ukrainian soldiers. That's something that's always going to be useful. Just recently, we hosted a medical training for first-year students at a medical university here, because it's becoming more and more prevalent for not only soldiers to know basic medicine, but also Ukrainian civilians. So that's something that we're trying to push out more and more to those people. The big things that have changed really are the much more widespread use of Russian armor, even with the FPV threat, getting the guys up to standard on knowing how to work. Sorry, I have a cat screaming at me at the moment. Getting the guys more up to standard on working together and as a group. And obviously the units are expanding and changing, and the direction of things are changing. So, but I would say at the moment, yeah, our two biggest focuses are the medical training and also the engineering training, which focuses on mine awareness and searching for mines and things.
Daniel, you have thousands of graduates. Are there any stories or people that stick in your mind that you would like to mention and just talk about a little bit to our listeners from the past few months? Who have you seen that we'd really want our listeners to be aware of, that you think their stories deserve to be told?
Yeah, we have a good connection with a lot of our students, especially our combat medics. We're one of the only providers of a combat medic course in Ukraine, and that's the course that we keep the closest connection with our students with. A lot of these combat medics really come to us as with either very low or even no medical training, and we try to provide them with enough to, in a 3-week package, with enough to save lives and be as effective as possible. One story that springs to mind, without names or anything, a medic of ours passed through our training. He was a young sort of artistic guy. He was Ukrainian, but he'd lived in Spain for a few years prior to the war. He rushed back to Ukraine at the beginning of the war, no military background, no military experience, and he came back to his hometown of Kharkiv, joined up, was put into the territorial defense unit of Kharkiv, and fought on the outskirts of the city, defending the city very hard for upwards of 6 months. Then his unit was continuously deployed to Bakhmut, the height of the fight in Bakhmut. And he sent us tons of videos, and a lot of them we actually have on our Instagram, him actively working, treating soldiers. And he ended up suffering from really bad shell shock after these things, and we still have regular communication with him. And that's one of, we're just about to hit 14,000 graduates. There's a ton of different stories, some good, some bad, and they all contribute to lessons learned and things that, you know, we can do better. We're always trying to improve ourselves, and obviously things that the Ukrainian army can do better. And we're lucky enough to have quite a large influence at a brigade and operational command level. We can make those changes. And I believe we've had quite a substantial impact in the last 2 years.
Just a final question from me, Daniel, then, before we go to our final thoughts. In your view, as a military trainer, what are the sort of the biggest challenges for the Ukrainian armed forces in the months and the year ahead? How do you see that?
I would say one of the biggest challenges will always be manpower, and that goes for both sides, obviously, with waves of mobilization, which, you know, inevitably, regardless of public opinion, both sides will have to conduct at some point. The war's been going on for coming up to almost 3 years now. With mobilization comes fresh people, comes fresh troops, and the standard of, it's not something that we necessarily provide, that sort of day one basic training, but definitely improving that sort of level of first step training for soldiers. And also, even before, you know, before you mobilize a man, or before a man volunteers to join the military, or woman, we have a lot of women serving in the Ukrainian military, is allowing the population of Ukraine to have access to a lot of resources, which allow them to prepare themselves. Because obviously, as we saw at the beginning of the war, you may be sitting at home and war can arrive on your doorstep, or you may be sent to that war. So definitely more preparation across the board, whether it be for the population or for soldiers. But that'll be one of the biggest challenges as the war goes on, is getting the new manpower up to scratch and making sure that the older guys, but the original guys that have been fighting since the beginning, that they get rest, that they get rotation, and they are able to give their experience to the newer people coming in.
Daniel, is there anything we haven't spoken about that you think is important to mention or important for our listeners to hear?
I think there's a lot going on in Ukraine at the moment. Odessa has been subject to some pretty horrific bombardments, including the recent cluster munition strike. Kharkiv is a bit out of the way. It's in the northeast of Ukraine, and I feel like sometimes it gets underrepresented, but it's Ukraine's second largest city, as one of Ukraine's largest population centers, and it sits merely 40 kilometers from the border with Russia, and it is subject to daily bombardments of all different types of munitions, missiles, rockets, glide bombs, you name it. And that's where a lot of support needs to be going at the moment, whether it pertains to air defense or whether it pertains to people wanting to donate to organizations or send equipment. I would implore people to focus a little bit more on Kharkiv, as it's had a rough time in the last 2 years.
Daniel Ridley, thank you so much for joining us. It's always really good to hear from you. Do stay safe, and we'll come back to you, of course, for your final thoughts. Coming up, we hear Dom, Francis, Joe, and Daniel's final thoughts. Dom Nichols, though, can I come to you first?
Yeah, thanks, David. So we spoke yesterday of the display in Moscow showing captured equipment from Ukraine, much of it donated from NATO and other external supporters of Ukraine. Well, unsurprisingly, the Russians have flocked to see it. State television there proclaimed that the star of the show was an American M1 Abrams tank, said to have been captured in eastern Ukraine. Clambering over the tank, a Channel 1 correspondent told viewers that it had been billed in the United States as an indestructible, quote, wonder weapon. Now, I'm not sure of the provenance of that quote, but hey, when has Russian state TV ever worried about actual facts? Anyway, the quote-unquote journalist said, "This was all nonsense. Look at this. All of its reputation has been destroyed." Now, dozens of vehicles, including others from Britain, Germany, France, made up the exhibit, each vehicle emblazoned with a flag of the country that had supplied it. And there were long queues of families forming yesterday, even before it's called the Trophies of the Russian Army exhibition opened. It was a national holiday, bank holiday yesterday in Russia. Now, look, Ukraine has displayed destroyed Russian vehicles in the centre of Kyiv. We've been there. I've reported on it. You'll be able to find that. I mean, this stuff is... that's fine, it can be used to raise morale, it can take the sting out of the enemy, it can show the public that the enemy are not 12 feet tall after all. It is important in war to highlight the humanness of your enemy. Now, not the humanity necessarily, there's a time and a place for that, but it's usually in the repair work after a war, not during it. But it is important to highlight the ordinariness of the enemy. I used to teach it as a resistance to interrogation technique. We'd say, you know, picture your interrogator naked or on the toilet or trying to put together flat pack furniture or anything like that, anything to humanize them, bring them down a size or two. So displaying this stuff can work for you, but it can cut both ways. And I know the utterly powerless ordinary people in Russian society have been fed a diet of nonsense their whole lives, but and it is a big but, what happens if enough of them are able to see past the propaganda here? That's what I'm interested in. So what does this display show? Well, it shows a lot of nations, not just in NATO, have donated kit to Ukraine. The Kremlin, of course, has gone into full victim fetishization mode and said that that's because poor old Russia's eternal struggle against the world. But some folk may look at this stuff and start to ask why only North Korea and Iran are supplying weapons. And all that Putin has really got out of his friends with benefits relationship with China, sorry, the no limits friendship, is a bit of technology and the pleasure of turning his country into a cheap filling station for Xi Jinping. All that's going to eventually be felt. There's another reason as well why this could blow up in the Kremlin's face, and that is that it's tough to show all this foreign kit, thereby bigging up the fight that you're in, and still claim that it's a special military fantasy, not an actual war. Yes, the society's grown up understanding the Russian cultural offering of Voronezh, where I'm lying, you know I'm lying, but we're just going to carry on as if you don't know, and I don't know you know. That's all well and good when it's just a little bit of corruption, a bit of intimidation, the odd murder. But this level of lying that's been laid out for all to see is way beyond that. The folks will, folks in normal society will be feeling it in the cost of food, in the stories creeping back from the front, in the loss of their kids going off to die. Putin has been successful and quite lucky that there's been no big societal reaction to this war so far. But literally putting it in front of people's faces, yes, it could bolster support for the war, but it could also plant some very unwelcome thoughts. And I hope that it does.
Thank you very much, Dom. Joe Barnes, can I come to you next for a brief final thought?
I thought it was really interesting. Remembering around what an intelligence source had said to me regarding that basically Russia has had to halt exports of fuel and is even buying it in from Belarus to mitigate the impact of Ukrainian strikes. Basically, Russia is losing its ability for these strikes, I think up to 15% of its ability to refine crude oil into fuel. And then interestingly this week, Politico started reporting that Russian fuel prices have jumped up 10% in the last week alone, and that is 20% since the beginning of the year. So you look at the reaction that we get in Britain the Western Europe, then Belgium has been prevalent as well, where I'm based, but the cost of living crisis, Russia was said to have been immune to this. Its own economy would stand on two feet, but now actually people driving their larders around Moscow will be paying extra for petrol. That means food prices go up. That means everything goes up. Anything that requires some sort of engineering capability jump up in price. Their televisions, everything. So I just think it's interesting. That is why Ukraine is doing this. Yes, it has sort of battlefield effect. It will stop Russia getting fuel supplies to the front line, but it will also create a bit of mayhem amongst the population. And that is why they're ignoring the Americans and carrying on with this capability. The long-range strike, sometimes 1,000 kilometres inside Russian territory. But I also think that has also settled the minds of the Americans, who have been more willing to send the long-range attackums into Ukraine. That's probably because they once had this red line which suggested we won't give Ukraine anything that they can do to strike deep inside Russia. But now they know the Ukrainians have their own kit that can do that. So actually they've been more likely to use Western weapons on targets in their own country. And I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Joe, and do enjoy your time off. Thank you for all of your work and your reporting. Francis Dernley.
Well, thanks, David. Yesterday, I spoke that it was the 20-year anniversary of the expansion of the EU, which encompassed many Central and Eastern European countries, seen as a very significant moment after the end of the Cold War. I asked listeners if they could share their memories of that time and reflect on its significance. And I just wanted to say thank you to all of those who have. We've received many fascinating emails. I'm going to read from one today from Andrei in Poland. He says, I'm a regular listener. Thank you for all of the work you do. Thank you, Andrei. What inspired me to write this email is the 20th anniversary of the accession of Poland to the EU you mentioned. I live in Poland. Younger generations will tell you that the EU is just a reality, like the air they breathe or like electricity in a socket. But I finished my secondary school when the Red Army was just about to leave Poland, almost 50 years after the end of World War II. And I remember quite well the discussion in public forums if this does not put Poland in a dangerous position, as the future relations with the United Germany was not secured yet. I remember the uncertainty of the people living in the western regions that Poland gained and was given after the war. 5 years later, I finished my studies and completed my military training in a non-NATO army. But already then, NATO and the EU seemed to be an obvious direction we as a nation had chosen. We were lucky to have politicians on both sides that didn't play out the debates from the past. UN and NATO accession was one of the most obvious and most commonly accepted decisions Poles ever made. Today, no matter what one can hear from different political and social spectrums, the common ground, the base, is the current status. Your question about significance of that moment 20 years ago from today's perspective is fascinating. It's a very hard answer to question, as we have gone quite a long way from where we were in the 90s. And as I mentioned before, the discussion is whether, had we not done that, be finding ourselves in the situation where Ukraine, Moldova or Belarus do today. It is clear now that there is no third way. Even Finland decided they could no longer stay halfway inside Western security systems any longer. I am therefore happy that Poland used a window of opportunity that hardly ever opens for our region. I guess once per 100 years maybe. And we have made it. So thank you to all of those who've reached out. It's really interesting hearing your perspective. And of course, it's highly relevant to the Ukraine situation and indeed what's happening in Georgia, because Ukrainians too would argue that this is one of those one in a century moments, which is why, of course, they get so frustrated when people talk about negotiations and don't seem to understand the gravity of the situation. But thank you.
Thank you, Dom, Francis and Joe. Daniel Ridley, would you like as our guest, the very final words?
I'll be rather quick because we are very relevant to our subject. We actually have cabs flying towards a city as I speak, and they're most likely due to land in the next few minutes. Yeah, I'll step a bit out my lane, but very relevant to what everyone else said and what Dom brought up at the beginning. Something that the Ukrainians have been doing since their capabilities got a lot stronger in the last year. You'll see these sort of retaliation strikes. You'll see the Russians retaliate to something that's happened in the war situation. And it's always very emotional. It's a very emotional reaction. We're expecting large strikes coming up to May Day, the Victory Day, as always is with the Russians, as it was before when I was on the front line, before the full scale. But the Ukrainians do this fantastic thing where the Russians will do an atrocious strike, an obvious war crime, an emotional reaction to something like the Iskander cluster munitions strike on a jogging park on the beach in Odessa that killed a bunch of civilians, dogs, and injured people. And then you'll see the Ukrainian reaction to that, which I would hazard to guess was the cluster munitions strike that Dom spoke about. See, the Russians will do something emotional, commit an obvious war crime, and the Ukrainians will respond with an incredibly precise strike, killing hundreds or tens, dozens of Russians, or damaging a lot of military equipment. And that's something the Ukrainians have been doing now for a year. And it's great to see the Ukrainians aren't reacting with the same emotions that the Russians have. They're reacting with precision, military strikes, justifiable strikes, whether that be inside of Russia or whether that be inside of the territory of Ukraine.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/Ukraine the Latest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our world affairs newsletter which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. London time each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to the podcast apps. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And, if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. As ever,
We are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest was produced by Giles Gear, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.